This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The elections of 2012 were the first road test of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, a ruling that allowed outside groups to spend much more freely on political messages. And now that the campaigning is over, there are two competing narratives about the role that money actually played. Here's the first, that despite all the hand-wringing about Citizens United allowing corporations and billionaires to buy our elections, big money ended up one of the biggest losers. These include candidates supported by conservative strategist Karl Rove's American Crossroads super PACs, which spent hundreds of millions with almost nothing to show for it. But here's the other interpretation, that while mountains of cash spent on negative TV ads and mailers may not have had the impact expected, money well spent mattered a lot. For example, those dollars fueling President Obama's Get Out the Vote effort. Also, money may have tipped the scales in smaller races. Here in New Hampshire, for instance, Republican Obed LaMontagne blamed a barrage of negative ads from national liberal groups for his loss in the governor's race against Maggie Hassan. Today in The Exchange, a post-election postmortem of Citizens United. We assess the impact of this decision and all the money that flowed because of it. And let's hear from you. How did you see money at work during this election? And did it, in the end, make a difference? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have two guests for the hour. Calvin Massey is with us in studio, professor of constitutional law and the First Amendment at UNH School of Law. And Calvin Massey, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Larry Noble, CEO and President of Americans for Campaign Reform, which is headquartered in Concord. Larry works in the D.C. office. Americans for Campaign Reform works to enact public funding of all federal elections. And Larry Noble, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, and Calvin, if you could, just step back for a quick minute and remind us how Citizens United in 2010 changed the rules of the road for campaigns and for elections, because for a long time there's been money in politics and lots of it. People have talked about super PACs for a long time. So how did Citizens United make this different?
Well, it struck down a couple of provisions of the McCain-Feingold Act, which had the effect then of permitting both corporations and labor unions to spend unlimited amounts of money from their general treasury funds. They're also eliminated certain restrictions upon so-called electioneering communications, which were political advertisements and other expenditures within 60 days of a federal election. And that opened the doors to essentially unlimited amounts of money to be spent by both labor unions and corporations on independent expenditures promoting the candidacy or the defeat of a particular candidate.
Yeah, and Larry Noble, what were the fears that you had and others who work in the campaign reform movement had about how this ruling would affect our elections? What were your sort of worst nightmares about this?
Well, I think the worst nightmare is that corporations and labor unions would come into the elections in a way that we had never seen before. And actually, the prohibitions on corporate and labor union involvement in federal elections goes back a long time. Corporations over 100 years, labor unions since the 1940s. So our fear was, and it turned out to be true, that there would be a tremendous amount of corporate and labor money spent in elections like we had never seen before.
So let's get into that then. So now all the voting's over. Larry, how do you judge this first road test of Citizens United? What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of our fears, as I said, did come true. There, by various estimates, there was probably close to $1 billion spent on just these by these outside groups and by corporations and labor unions in the elections. And it did have an effect. You know, one thing you have to look at is where the money came from. And for the first time, we're really seeing these corporations become big players and individuals become big players. So I think it tremendously distorted the election. I think it made voters feel more distant from their elected officials, because how do you play in a system where somebody can raise $50 million or give $50 million to a super PAC? And so I think, and keep in mind that this is the first presidential election that we've seen super PACs. And I think this is just the beginning of, unless we do something about it, of what's going to be a massive influence of corporate money and labor money in our elections. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, not just at the federal level, at the state and local level also.
Well, and Larry, the headline, though, that has come out after the election was big money ended up in many cases being a big loser. So how did Citizens United, in your opinion, distort the election, as you said?
Well, first, as I said, you have to start off with where did the money come from? And those who are benefiting from the money, and a lot of people did benefit from it, look at where the money came from and who they owe favors to afterwards. But this narrative that they had no effect, I think, is wrong. First of all, at the presidential level, they may have fought to a draw, in a sense, especially given how much money President Obama had to spend on a ground game and a lot of other factors. So they were there. They did have an impact. But it's clear they also had an impact on races at the congressional level and at the state and local level. And so I think that it is true that big money did not always win. And in many cases, big money did not win in the spending of the super PACs. And that just proves one thing, that money can't always determine the outcome of an election and that candidates can fight against super PACs. However, I think it is wrong to say that means they had no effect at all in the elections and that they did not totally distort the process.
What would you say, Calvin Massey, excuse me, how would you judge the first real test of Citizens United?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there was an enormous amount of money spent, more than has been spent in the past. I'm not sure that I agree with Larry that big money didn't succeed. Labor unions, when you count all expenditures from labor unions, not just on advertising, outspent corporate expenditures by a considerable amount. And I think it's fair to say labor union expenditures were reasonably effective. So
in that Democrats had
some
major
gains. Successful election for Democrats. So to the extent that one believes that the beneficiary of those expenditures is now indebted to the source of the money, one would expect that successful Democratic politicians will feel indebted to labor unions. I don't think that's surprising, but I think it's big money. I wouldn't say they fought to a draw. Two sides of big money fought, and one side lost. And that's the nature of politics. One side's going to be effective, and the other side's not. Whether that's a result of how the money was spent, and perhaps the Democrats were better at spending it on get out the vote campaigns than were the Republicans. That's a sort of a tactical issue. I'm not so sure that the size of the money matters all that much. If we spend 10 times as much money in a single year on video games in this country as we do on political campaigns. And political campaigns are, frankly, a lot more important than many video games.
So you're not so much worried about these huge sums that we keep hearing dramatic.
I'm not worried about them so much. I think what's more pernicious is the sort of false and misleading campaign advertisements that both sides create. But I don't think there's any way to control those. The idea of having some sort of governmental censor to control the content of the advertising is absolutely anathema. But I do think that negative advertising works, and negative advertising is often downright false and misleading.
Lots more questions, gentlemen, but let me also invite our listeners to join us. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. How did you see big money at work during this past election? Did it, in the end, make a difference in the outcomes? What do you think, overall, the impact of Citizens United was, given that this is the first real test of this decision in the 2012 elections? Our number here in the exchange, again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. What do you think about this idea, Larry Noble, that perhaps some of the biggest spenders ended up being the biggest losers because they didn't spend the money well, so money did matter. You just had to spend it in the right way. What do you think about that, Larry?
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, there are a lot of factors in an election, the amount of money you spend, the nature of your candidate, your message, and your strategy. But but something that Calvin said, I agree with, but I think we need to clarify. When I said that the big money may not have had the effect, I'm talking about super PACs. Clearly, big money has a tremendous effect on all elections. Money is one of the great influencers of elections. Now, super PACs themselves are a specific subset of the big money, and I think there's a lot of question about that corporate money and labor money that was spent. Now, a lot of the labor money that Calvin is talking about was spent on ground operations and was not necessarily independent expenditures. But we believe that the amount of money spent is critically important, not so much in terms of the amount of money you spend, but how much you have to raise to spend that money and where that money comes from. And I just don't accept the idea that when somebody can give $1 million to a super PAC or give $100,000 to a campaign or raise $500,000 for a campaign, that they don't have undue influence over that campaign.
So it's not just the election, it's what happens after the election.
It's very much what happens after the election. Now is the time when the people who raised that money, who spent that money, are going to the members of Congress and saying, here are our issues, here's what we need. And if you're not bothered by that, then I think that it goes to your concept of what we are as a representative democracy. I'd like to think that even though I'm not capable of giving that type of money, my representative will listen to me. But all the evidence is that, in fact, as one would expect, they have to respond to those who raise and gave a lot of money.
Well, and just real quick before we go into the break, Larry, we had a listener who called who couldn't stay on but wanted to know if we know what percentage of money spent on this election cycle came from corporations and what percentage came from unions. Do you have that breakdown, Larry, or a rough idea?
I don't have that breakdown, but one of the issues here is when we talk about money from unions, a lot of their money, as I said before, doesn't go to super PACs. They did fund super PACs, but a lot of it goes to ground operations. That is much harder to track. So there is clearly a problem on both sides. But the unions do spend a lot of money on elections. They have traditionally spent a lot of money on elections, and they have the ability to get out union members to do ground games. That can be incredibly effective.
All right. And we will take more of your emails, calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on the impact of Citizens United on the 2012 elections on the exchange on NHPR. Then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, President Obama and priorities for the lame duck Congress. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny, high temperatures between 40 to 45 degrees, coolest readings along northern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from UR members. M. Frum, New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, now offering 7 MBA programs on site and online. Program details and registration at nec.edu. And from Granite Investment Advisors, introducing a locally managed mutual fund option for long-term value investors. More information available at 888-442-9893. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the impact of the Citizens United decision on the 2012 elections. We invite you to join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. As we've been hearing, predictions were that these elections would allow outside groups to play a huge role in our elections and that money would sway the outcome. Now, some say that wasn't really the case. We're looking at how big an impact Citizens United really had on our elections this year, and we invite you with your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. In the end, what do you think the impact was of the Citizens United election on our voting this year? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guests are Larry Noble, CEO and President of Americans for Campaign Reform, and Calvin Massey, Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at UNH School of Law. And gentlemen, here's an email. This is from Ken in Farmington. He says, while it is true that big money didn't always deliver wins, we're looking at a sample of one. Usually big money does correlate with wins. Ken says there are many factors which lead to losses. Among them, Governor Romney focused on a certain group of white, well-off voters to the exclusion of the rest. Ken says there are other things for which money can't compensate. That doesn't mean money played no role. The Swift voters happened, and Citizens United opens the door wider. Ken, thanks for the email. And Calvin Massey, what do you think?
Well, you know, money does matter. That's why money facilitates speech. It's not, you know, we talk about money, but what we're really talking about is speech. All money does is facilitate speech. And so the bottom line of these complaints about Citizens United is people think there's too much speech. And that's an odd complaint in a country that is devoted to the First Amendment, particularly when it comes to political speech. What the First Amendment was designed to protect above all else was our capacity for self-governance and to speak about politics. And so I have a hard time understanding why we are so exercised over the fact that there is more speech rather than less speech.
Well, it's the point, I think, that Larry made before, that he'd like to feel as a citizen that his voice counts as much as, you know, people who give hundreds of millions to a campaign, and that it's disheartening to sort of see yourself stacked up against those well-moneyed interests.
Sure, sure. But the problem with that is, well, what's the remedy then? If the remedy is that we're going to prevent certain people from speaking, or from speaking by using money to facilitate speech, then where is the stopping point? Some people are more articulate than others. Lawyers, as a class, are generally more articulate. Are we going to put a limitation on the amount of speech that lawyers may utter in political campaigns? Are we going to put a limitation on the amount of speech that that commentators on the radio, on television, or in print may speak, simply because they're more articulate? I think Larry's real concern is he believes that there's a corrupting influence as a result of this amount of money. And we already have limitations in place that deal with that form of corruption, the so-called quid pro quo corruption, where you give a large contribution directly to a political campaign. And that is limited. What we're talking about here are expenditures that are made independent of the political candidates that aren't given to the campaign. They do have a benefit to that campaign, and that's what Larry's concerned about, that there's an insidious form of a sense of indebtedness that the successful candidate
you
has.
You gave me money, so I will support your issues in Congress.
Yeah, not that the person gave the candidate money, but spent money in a way that benefited the candidate. And now, with that sense of indebtedness, I'm going to be more attuned to what that person's views are.
Larry, if you could just real quick jump in on this fundamental free speech issue. Boy, we've been going back and forth on this for decades, it seems, Larry. Do limits on political spending equal limits on free speech?
I don't think they should be unconstitutional limits on free speech. And I think Calvin hit the nail on the head when he said the real question is whether money or when he said that money does equal speech. And I disagree with that. Yes, the Supreme Court did say that because it takes money to speak, that any restriction on money has to be seen as a restriction on speech. And I think that was a very bad decision, because what it effectively says is that in our country, those with more money have more right to speech. Now, you know, Calvin mentions, and we hear this often, the idea of, well, somebody is more articulate than somebody else, so they have an advantage. Somebody is a better-looking candidate. And yes, there are a lot of advantages we have in life, and one of the things we decide as a society is those things that we think are important and those things we don't think are important. And we've now decided that money should be considered very important. Well, in other societies, they decide that those who have the most arms, most guns, have the most speech. And because we don't want a society like that, we have rules about those type of things. And saying that money just has to naturally equal speech, I think is wrong. I don't think it's written anywhere other than by our Supreme Court that money makes you a better person, gives you more right to have a say in our society. I also think that Calvin's right that the concern is corruption. And when we talk about these independent expenditures, they're independent in fiction only. We are seeing people from the campaigns go and work for these super PACs. We are seeing now that super PACs arise that really work for only one candidate. So it's really difficult to understand how, in anybody's view, they are truly independent. So after the election, obviously the candidate is going to feel beholden to the super PACs. And when you ask, can anything be done about this? Yes, public funding. We actually had a presidential public funding system that worked for a number of years. We have public funding at the state level and at local levels that works. And small donor public funding, which is what we advocate, is a system where you basically empower small donors, bring them back into the process by having them make a contribution, having the government match that contribution, raising the value of that contribution to the candidate, and then giving them a larger voice in the campaign.
And I want to ask you definitely about public money in just a second. But on the free speech issue, here's an email, Larry, from Jack in Manchester that just came in. He says, the limitations on independent expenditures in the McCain-Feingold law were obvious and blatant abridgments of the freedom of speech and of the press, that the First Amendment explicitly protects against such abridgments. Jack asks, what part of Congress shall make no law are proponents of such legislation incapable of understanding or appreciating? Thanks, Jack, for the email. Real quick to you, Larry. He's disagreeing with you there.
Right. The First Amendment says shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. It does not say the freedom of money. And that's really what the crux of the argument is that, yes, I am a firm believer in the First Amendment. I'm a firm believer in free speech. I don't think that those who have the most money have the most right to speech. Let me just give you one very quick statistic from 2010. Less than 0.26% of the U.S. population gave over $200 in a federal election. We are talking about a very, very, very small percentage of people right now who have any say in the money election that we have, who feel at all that they can have a say in this. And so I just don't accept the proposition that we are a country that is devoted to the idea of protecting money as speech, and that those with the most money have the most speech.
Well, and as we talk at the impact of Citizens United and the money that flowed from it in these elections, I want to focus more closely now on New Hampshire, gentlemen. To help us out with that is Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Sure. Hi. Good morning, Laura.
Was there more outside money, Dean, coming into New Hampshire this election cycle than in past election cycles? Did we see more?
Yeah, it was a pretty large chunk of money, particularly in the gubernatorial race, where we saw upwards of about $12 million spent by outside groups. I think in the second CD, which was Annie Custer and Charlie Bass, a couple million dollars spent by outside groups there, mainly to target Bass on Medicare. And we've been talking about this for a number of years now. Every election cycle, the amount of money spent by these outside groups, particularly now that they're less constrained legally, keeps increasing.
So can we attribute this increase in money spent, Dean, to Citizens United, or was it partly due to our swing state status, our purple state status, where we could have gone either way?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, to be honest. New Hampshire obviously has had a heightened role in the presidential election process in recent cycles. We're getting a lot of attention, not just for the New Hampshire primary anymore. But I also think that, there were a couple of high-profile races. Our gubernatorial race was a pretty high-profile race, given some of the issues at stake, like gay marriage in the state, also the sense that particularly that second CD, that congressional seat that Charlie Bass had. He's a pretty senior member of the House, and people thought it was an opportunity for a Democratic pickup and one that may potentially turn out to be fairly long-term. So, I think it was probably a little bit of each.
Did super PAC spending, Dean, can we even say for sure whether this money swayed the outcome of any of our races here in New Hampshire? For example, over the Montaigne, in his speech accepting defeat, blamed the national groups for what he called, a barrage of negative ads against him.
Right. Well, here's the thing on that, and obviously Ovid was, really upset by the outcome on election night. But whenever I try to figure out whether or not outside money is having an impact, I typically ask myself, did that outside money in any significant way change the likely campaign narrative? So, and in my sense, in that race in particular, not really. It's true that Maggie Hassan got a lot of money from NARAL and Emily's List and Planned Parenthood. I think because of some of the issues that were at stake. But I think the reality is the strategy that she used, which was to take the pledge and then focus the campaign on Ovid being too socially conservative, was the strategy she would have used in any event. And it's the same strategy that Jean Shaheen used to beat him fairly easily in 1996. So for me to say that outside money had a significant impact, I would need to see some way in which the kind of expected winning strategy, which is what Hassan chose, was in some way changed by that amount of money. So, you know, I think if $1 million had been spent in that race, her strategy would have worked. It turned out, you know, a total of $12 million was spent, and she was hit by some negative ads as well from outside groups about, you know, living for free at a house over in Exeter. So, you know, I think people are going to be trying to measure this for a long time to come, my sense in that particular race was the way the race played out, it would have played out that way whether $1 million was spent or whether $6 million was spent, because there are other structural factors and ideological factors that work in the electorate.
So it didn't change the campaign narrative. I hear you on that, Dean, although one
yeah.
could argue that it gave that narrative a much bigger and louder microphone.
Sure, I think that's a possibility. I think that's fair to say, particularly in a presidential year where there's so much attention focused on what happens at the top of the ticket. There is a lot of competition to get, you know, visibility for your message. But again, I think that to me, my sense was that it would have played out this way irrespective of the amount of money. But sure, and to go back to something that your guest said earlier, which I think is very important, you know, there are different ways in which you can spend a lot of money. So if we're talking about super PACs spending outside money, I think that the figure I've seen is that outside groups spent about $700 million this cycle, which is amazing. You know, then we can say the return on the dollar was fairly low. But if you're talking about just having a lot of money spent on campaigns in general, for getting out the vote and other types of organization and activities, sure, you know, having more money can really make a difference.
All right. Dean, thanks a lot.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, looking at the influence of outside money in New Hampshire's elections this year. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the impact of Citizens United more broadly on the 2012 elections, and we want your thoughts and questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Larry Noble, Calvin Massey, let's go to our listeners now. And Armand is calling in from Windsor, Vermont. Hi, Armand, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing? I listen to your show a lot.
Good.
The main thing that I have, that all this money that came in from both sides, was the negativity of it. The not factual, they weren't actual facts. Like, they would say things that were half true, but not all true. And sometimes they would say things that were blatantly not even true. And I think that does have an impact. One of your guests just said that earlier, that labor unions outspent corporations. And then you asked the second, the person called in and said, do you really have the facts on that? And they said no, the other guest. But what he said is out there now, and people heard that, even though he doesn't even know, but he said it. And sometimes people just take sound bites out of things, and that's what they go with.
And thank you for the call. And Calvin Massey, you know, you mentioned this earlier, that a lot of the advertising, Armin's right, was negative, was half true. Is that what we expected coming out of Citizens United?
Well, it's, excuse me.
Not that was a new phenomenon.
No, that's what I was about to say. It's been a staple of American politics since we invented the country. I don't know that they... half-truths, the falsities, and the misleading speech that is uttered in campaigns now is any worse than it has been in the past. It's deplorable, but I don't think that we have any constitutional mechanism for controlling it. An even worse system would be some governmental censor that determines what you may say in a political advertisement. That is smacks of a totalitarian regime. So I think we have to put up with the negative advertising and hope that people are smart enough to see through it. And generally, I think they are.
Larry, you know, there's the idea of this supposed separation between the campaigns and the super PACs or the unions doing the advertising. So the advertiser, whoever the funder, may say something that's kind of, you know, negative, half true, half not true. For example, the Maggie Hassan, you know, that Dean Spiliotis mentioned, she doesn't pay taxes. You know, you hear that at first and you go, whoa, what's that about? But then you realize, okay, she lives on the grounds of a private school, so it would make sense that she wouldn't. When the other side, the people who put out that ad, when the campaign is accused of saying, look, you're distorting the truth here, the campaigns can just say, well, I didn't say that. That's that other group, and I've never met that person. So there's a separation there that sometimes makes things difficult. I think that's one of the points that Armin brings up for me.
Yes, and that's right. And that is a problem that we've had for a long time. You know, and there are a couple of things if you unpack that. There are a couple of issues here. One has to do with the concept of what is an independent expenditure. And the law says that they cannot be coordinated with a campaign, and the Federal Election Commission has been very ineffective in enforcing that rule. So you have this fiction of independence. So the candidate can say, oh, I had nothing to do with that ad, though they are their supporters, people who they know, people who they raise funds for, who are putting on those ads. So it's somewhat of a fiction. But as Calvin said, there's a limited amount you can do about some of that, because we do have the First Amendment. I agree with him on this issue that when you get to the substance of the ads, that it's really up to the press to do its job in fact-checking. It's up to the candidate to show how the other side is not necessarily telling the truth. And that should have consequences in elections, and it may have had a consequence in this election. But that is a separate problem from the problem of the money that's being raised to put on these ads, the money that's being raised by the campaigns, and where that money is coming from. Because after all the smoke is cleared, after you know, we're sitting here now talking about what happened in the 2012 election as if it's over. It's not over. It's only beginning in the sense that now as members come to Congress, lobbyists are going to be there. The people who raise the money for the campaigns, not only the super PACs, are going to have their representatives there talking to members of Congress, telling them what they want. And so the election is only a snapshot in time. But what we've done in this election is that we've created a whole system of money influence that is going to continue now through the next election.
Well, let me ask Calvin real quickly about that, because you've raised that point a couple times, Larry. So let's hit it on the head. Calvin, can you address this legislating concern that Larry talks about, that candidates will remember who helped them, and that's why they'll vote the way they do? If they get a lot of money from oil and gas, for example, they're going to vote against climate change legislation.
Well, it's the nature of representative government that an elected representative would respond to the concerns of those who supported him. I don't think there's anything unusual about that. When you get elected, you've gotten elected on a platform. You seek to enact it. You respond to the people who supported you. And if the people who supported you happen to be the oil and gas industry, well, then presumably it's the voters who also agreed that the oil and gas industry, in this example, was. Had a viewpoint that's worth being enacted. I don't see that there's anything pernicious in that. That's not corruption. That's democracy in action.
All right. We will take more of your calls and emails after a very short break, so keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, celebrating the first 100 resident-owned manufactured housing communities in New Hampshire, communityloanfund.org. And from Republic, New Hampshire's original certified local farm-to-table restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, Elm Street, Manchester, online at republiccafe.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR has logged a lot of miles this year, from the Northern Pass Project to the hepatitis outbreak at Exeter Hospital to tracking candidates ahead of New Hampshire's many elections. Your old car has logged a lot of miles, too, as you've listened into our signature reporting. So, as the tax year winds down, consider taking advantage of our vehicle donation program. We'll take care of all the paperwork, pick up your car, and auction it off. All you need to do is call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, Granite Staters with connections to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in Gaza join us. You can email us your comments or questions for our panel to exchange at NHPR.org before the program, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at the impact of Citizens United on the recent elections, and we want your thoughts and questions. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And Calvin Massey, Larry Noble, let's go right back to our callers. And Tom's waiting in Manchester. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple comments about how the candidates spent their money. I'm a young voter, and like many millions of Americans, I've changed the way I access my media over the last 4 years. So I canceled my cable, and I wanted to tie in one of your panelists said earlier about how video game sales are so much higher than campaign spending. And every time I logged into my PlayStation or my Xbox, I saw advertisements for Barack Obama, but I didn't see anything for Mitt Romney. And I think that's a way that he spent more wisely and utilized that money differently.
So money mattered, Tom, but perhaps some didn't spend the money wisely. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because, you know, I never saw any of the negative ads that you guys are talking about because myself, like I said, like a lot of other millions of Americans, I don't have cable, so I wouldn't see all that, you know, that negative advertising. But what I did see was a lot of Facebook advertising and a lot of advertising on these other venues where so many Americans are going.
Yeah, it was sort of a new world in terms of where these ads might pop up. What do you think, Larry? We touched on this earlier, but is it that Democratic-leaning organizations just spent better this time around? Is that the lesson? Money matters, but you got to spend it the right way?
I think in some ways that, yes, that is true. I think that we saw the Obama campaign has a tremendous outreach effort in terms of identifying voters. The use of new media is something that the campaigns have to stay on top of and, frankly, ahead of. So the idea of you log on to Xbox and you see ads is something that you would not have seen election cycle ago. And so this is very much a game of staying ahead of the curve on this and making sure you reach people in the most efficient way, in most efficient way possible. I do want to say one thing. I don't want to let this stay there, but what Calvin said about the nature of representative government. I thought the nature of representative government was that people respond to the people who elected them, not the people who necessarily gave them the most money. And I think that's a fundamental difference in how we do this. And I think that that money is going to be used for all sorts of ways of reaching the voters, whether it be through the Xbox, whether it be through online ads, Facebook. But at the end of the day, you always have to follow that money back to its source.
Well, it's interesting, too, and you and our caller talked about different ways that money was spent. There was advertising on YouTube. Larry, I played a little game one day on Pandora Internet Radio. I kept going to different radio sites and seeing which campaign would advertise on which stations. So like the jazz station, there were more Barack Obama ads. The classical music station, there were more Mitt Romney ads. So that's another example of how they use the money in new and unique ways. Right, Larry, this time?
Absolutely. And there are people who are paid a lot of money to figure that out. There are people who on the campaigns and working for these independent groups whose job is to figure out where's the most effective way to put our ad and how do you phrase that ad. The ad you hear on a jazz station may very well be different than an ad you hear on an old news station, which will be very different than an ad you hear on a classic rock station. So they are very much targeting their audiences, and this is a whole profession in Washington and in the states on how you target your audiences and how you target your message.
All right. And Calvin Massey, real quick to you, and then back to our listeners.
I just want to respond to one thing that Larry said. Larry seems to assume that money purchases votes. It doesn't. Money purchases speech. And speech persuades voters. So ultimately, representative democracy means that the candidate who's elected, even if he's been elected as the result of speech that's been facilitated by gobs of money, is responding to voter preferences. And that's representative democracy. I really think you have to realize that money doesn't directly purchase votes. It purchases speech, and speech persuades. And once people are persuaded and they elect a candidate, then it's entirely appropriate for that candidate to respond to those apparent preferences of the voters.
We talk to politicians, Larry, all the time about this, and they say, look, groups give me money because I believe in their causes, from the Sierra Club to the insurance industry to oil and gas to whatever. So they say, no, money doesn't influence my vote. I already vote that way. That's why they give to me. So it's kind of a chicken and egg issue that we're going around on this.
Yes, but it's not the way the contributors see it. I have to say, I just spent 6 years in a private law firm advising corporations, various organizations, trade associations on compliance with campaign finance laws. And I have to tell you, it would come as a big surprise to the individual contributors, the corporations involved in this, I'm sure to the labor unions involved in this, if you told them that the money they're spending was not going to get them access and get them some influence after the election. They wouldn't do it if they thought that was the case. The bottom line for them is they're doing this to get that access after the election.
Let's take some more calls. And to Nottingham, where Dan is waiting. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just to that last point that Larry made, I mean, empirically, we don't know that that is the case. Empirically, the evidence is extremely mixed as to whether or not spending on campaigns influences votes or influences any behavior out that. So while corporations may think that they're buying influence, there really is no clear evidence. And I think that's important to point out. That we just don't know what's happening after that.
So skeptical, Dan, that all the spending really does buy access, influence, et cetera.
Well, I'm not skeptical. I'm just I mean, this is something that I'm pretty familiar with, and we don't know the answer yet. Right? There's research that's taking place, and it's just not clear. So empirically, we can't say that it buys influence. We can say that people spend money, that they might be looking for something in return. But we cannot empirically say whether or not they're receiving anything in return. And that's important to point out, that the research just is not clear. So to say that it is buying influence is erroneous.
All right, Dan, thanks for calling in. What do you think, Calvin Massey?
I think, well, I sort of agree with Dan. I don't know that we know for sure, and I think individual elected members of Congress probably vary. I think it is quite likely that money is spent by contributors to purchase speech to support people who already have evidenced a disposition to vote in the way in which those contributors would want them to vote. So I think it probably mostly reinforces prior voting patterns. I think it'd be highly unusual. Let's take Ovid LaMontagne as an example. If money had been spent by Narol, or Emily's List in support of Ovid LaMontagne, would that have changed his views? Would he have, had he been elected governor, suddenly have become a social liberal? Who knows? But I think it highly unlikely. So it seems to me that the reason Narol supports Maggie Hassan is because they're pretty confident that she'll vote in the direction that they already like.
Although their money does give her, as we talked about with Dean Spiliotis, Calvin, a bigger microphone, a louder microphone.
It does indeed.
It amplifies her speech.
It does. It does.
And is that fair? Is that okay?
Well, the alternative is to say that we can squelch some speakers in order to permit we can turn the volume down on some speakers in order to increase the volume on others. And that is a principle that's frankly foreign to the First Amendment. We don't do that. We allow people, we recognize that some people are more persuasive than others. Some are more articulate, some have better platforms. But to get into the business of saying, you're speaking too much, we're not going to allow you to speak anymore. At what point do we say, well, Laura Kanoy, you've spent 40 minutes here. I mean, that's all you get. We're now going to close down the program. And a government censor comes in here and does that. That's anathema to the First Amendment.
Let's take another call. Dan, thanks for that one. This is Don in Andover. Hi, Don. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you. Because in 4 years ago, Obama had a great increase in small contributors, and because of the Citizens United decision, I elected as a small contributor to increase my contributions to the Obama campaign. And that was predicated upon the Citizens United decision.
So Citizens United concerns over corporate money, for example, unleashed by Citizens United, made you contribute more to the Obama campaign, Don? Is that what you're saying?
As a small contributor, I felt it was my necessity to contribute more.
What do you think?
Than I had 4 years ago, yes.
What do you think about that, Larry Noble? Thanks, Don, for the call.
I think that's a very important reaction. I think, regardless of which candidate you're supporting, I think that's something very important for contributors to do, to contribute as a way is fighting against the super PACs. But, you know, the reality is, though, that they can give relatively little money, I assume. I don't know Don's situation, but most contributors can give relatively little money. One of the things that a matching public funding system does is magnify their money. But, you know, again, what the super PACs did and the money given to the super PACs is one thing. At the same time, though, all this money is still being given directly to the candidates. And that is where the contributors are giving who really directly want some influence. And Calvin said that we don't do that in this country, meaning we don't restrict the speech of some and tell some they can't speak. And actually, we do. The Supreme Court said foreign nationals can't do this. That was a big issue, whether foreign nationals can make independent expenditures. Right now, the law is they can't. So we have made a judgment here that foreign nationals do not have the same rights as everybody else in this country in terms of speech. So we're really just talking about where we're going to draw a line here. But the idea of bringing small donors into this is incredibly important. I think that's what this democracy has to be all about, is about empowering small donors, about empowering the average voter to feel like they not only can go to the election on an election day, not only vote, but after the election they have a say in their process. Their vote actually meant something. And not that they are then drowned out. And as far as empirical evidence goes, we always hear this. Look at the results of what happens after the election. Look at the legislation. Look at why certain things cannot get done in Washington. And as I like to say, money in politics is the framing issue for everything else. You can do a correlation between what gets done and the money. Causations are very hard to prove, but this is a functioning democracy, and we have to be very careful that we don't just try to say, oh, well, unless we can prove to a scientific certainty X, Y, and Z, we're not going to take care of the problem. The problems are corroding our democracy, and I think that's something we have to all be concerned about.
Don, thanks for the call. Did you want to jump in, Calvin?
Just briefly. To raise the issue of foreclosing foreign nationals from contributing to American electoral campaigns is a bit of a red herring. We're talking about the American polity here. Of course, we don't let foreign nationals vote, and it's entirely appropriate to foreclose them from contributing to influence elections. They're not part of the American polity. But with respect to people who are here and part of the self-governance, there we don't engage in the practice of saying, well, who can speak and who can't speak.
Here's an email sent from Jeremy, who says, isn't the real impact of Citizens United and money in politics generally that elected officials need to spend overwhelming amounts of time raising money and granting access in exchange for money rather than performing their function once in office? Jeremy says federal elected officials end up attending a fundraiser each day, more even at times. This, Calvin, again, gets to Larry's concern that it isn't just about the election. It's about how you act once you're in office. I have talked to politicians who, to a person, are dismayed at how much time they have to spend on the phone with fundraisers and going to fundraisers, hours and hours and hours a day when they could be, you know, working on legislation.
I would agree with that. I think that you know, it's an unfortunate reality that as much of your time, I suspect, is spent worrying about getting the money for the next election as it is governing the country. And that's plainly not good.
Let's take one more call if we could. This is Frank in Bedford. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Before my major point, foreign nationals could give them this campaign because there was no requirement that the donor be disclosed. They could keep their names secret. China could have contributed $1 billion if they wanted to. But my main point is, last week, New Hampshire and the nation lost a great man, Senator Warren Rudman. And Senator Rudman formed a group with Gary Hart called Just $6. He believed that large contributions were corroding and corrupting American democracy, and he thought we were losing democracy. The fact that the Koch brothers gave over $100 million of their own money meant that if Mitt Romney, thank God he didn't get elected, but had he gotten elected, the Koch brothers could have called Mitt on any given day and said, Mitt, we want to meet with you on an issue, and you damn well better support that issue. So money does buy access. The whole First Amendment issue is just a phony, ridiculous issue. I support Senator Rudman's Just $6 and eliminate all other campaign money, and then every American has an equal voice to reach our politicians.
Well, and Frank, thanks for the call. And real quick, gentlemen, because we're getting close to the end. So, Larry Noble, we should say that Warren Rudman was also part of Americans for Campaign Reform, your group. We talked about that on, I believe it was Wednesday, when we observed his passing.
Yes, Warren Rudman was one of our four co-chairs. We are a bipartisan group, and we are just $6. I mean, we ultimately came just $6. And I think Warren Rudman was a great man. And I think what he knew and what former candidates will tell you is the money does corrupt. And that's why we have former candidates. We have former members of Congress who are part of our group on both Republicans and Democrats who will say, like Warren Rudman said, that this system doesn't work, that you have to do something about it. And he devoted part of his life to this because he understood the damage to our democracy. And as a co-chair of our group, he was incredibly helpful to us in speaking out about this issue. So the people who do know the most about this, the people who ran for office, the people who served us, have spoken out and said this is very corrupted.
Well, and to his second point, and I'll throw this to you, Calvin, Frank said this First Amendment stuff is, to quote him, a phony, ridiculous issue.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear someone in the audience have such a misguided understanding of the First Amendment. That's distressing and disappointing. It probably points to a lack of civic understanding as to the meaning of the First Amendment. I'd also like to say to our last caller that if he thinks that Mitt Romney would have been a puppet of the Koch brothers, I suspect that Barack Obama will pick up the phone if Richard Trumka, if the AFL-CIO, should give him a call.
All right. Well, both of you, lots more to wade through. Larry Noble, thank you for making the time for us this morning. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Larry Noble, CEO and President of Americans for Campaign Reform, headquartered in Concord. Larry joined us from the D.C. office. Americans for Campaign Reform works to enact public funding of all federal elections. And Calvin Massey, it's good to see you, too. Thank you for being
here. Thank you. My pleasure.
Calvin Massey, Professor of Constitutional Law and the First Amendment at UNH School of Law. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, Granite Staters reflect on Middle East turmoil. For weeks, Israelis and Palestinians in Gaza have traded rocket fire and airstrikes, and now, even though there's a ceasefire, relations are still tense. We'll talk with New Hampshire residents connected to both sides in this conflict. We'll get their thoughts and what they're hearing from friends and family in the region. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next.